I'm Scott Kirzner, and I run the weblog Cinematech, which you can find at cinematech.blogspot.com. This is the recording of an interview I conducted in early August with John Iraklis, president of Exodus Film Group, and Max Howard, who's working with Exodus on a CG animated film called Igor. Howard's the one with the British accent, and he was formerly president of Warner Brothers Feature Animation, where he worked on Space Jam and Iron Giant, and before that, a senior vice president at Disney Feature Animation, where he was involved with The Lion King, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and The Little Mermaid. Exodus is working on a film called Paul Bunyan and Babe the Blue Ox. They're located in Venice, California, and they have an animation division called Electro Age.
Give me kind of an overview of what, you know, what Exodus and Electro Age are working on right now, kind of what the projects are that are in
gestation. We've got several projects that we're working on. First one being Bunyan and Babe, which is a combination of live action and animation. And we'll be shooting the live action portion of it this fall. The guys have already developed and rigged the character and the voice is recorded, so we're ready to drop him in. And we're working with Max on three animated pictures, all in different budget ranges, Igor being the one that we are currently moving forward on, the other two being in development. And they look great so far. We're really excited.
And how does Bunyan and Babe integrate live action and animation? I mean, that's something that you know, has been done before, but maybe you guys are taking a different approach to that.
Well, we feel fortunate that we've got Jim Rigel on board, who did the all of the special effects direction on Lord of the Rings, mm-hmm. and considered the father of Gollum. And so he has a real knack of making you feel like that animated character is alive and part of the scene.
So, but does it use? Are you shooting live action sets and scenes and kind of bringing animated characters into that?
Just one animated character, correct. Uh-huh. Live action, green screen, and drop the character in afterwards.
Does it use motion capture as well?
No.
You know, I guess one of the things that I'm interested in is, you know, from your perspective, obviously you're trying to do these productions, you know, without having to raise a huge amount of money. So what are some of the kind of tools or technologies or approaches you're using that are, you know, new or relatively new, you know, that kind of help you do more with less, basically?
Sure. Well, maybe Max.
Well, I don't think it's a technological answer, really. I think it's you start with a good script.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's the easy answer and it's the hardest thing to do. And if you start with something that you really like and you spend time before you start trying to make the film and getting the script right, then the costs of making the film dramatically come down.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they won't go up, is what normally right. happens. You're trying to put it together as you go. And I think, you know, the guys at Electro Age, you know, are full of great ideas on how to do things, but essentially, you know, it really comes down to just getting it right, planning it correctly.
Okay, so if we say story is paramount here,
yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the setup and the tools that you will be using, whether it's for Igor or for Bunyan and Babe.
Well, I can tell you that the guys really have a philosophy which is not to reinvent the wheel. Mm-hmm. And if we were to take you next door to the studio, you'd see that all the render racks and all the machines that they're using are literally built by them and using off-the-shelf technology. We're not spending a tremendous amount of money on R&D. We're not trying to create the next for texture or any of those things. We're really trying to use the tools that have already been generated and use them in a way that may be a little different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that is a key, not to have to write so many plugins and really so you're creating and driving a whole brand new software. It's really using off the shelf, which is, of course, I think that's the great advent that's happened in the last few years. You go back, you know, just a few years, and PDIs, you know, Pixar's Rhythm and Hues, you know, the only way they could be in the business was to
write their own software. Yeah.
And now you don't have to do that. And
yeah.
That's what's opened the door to so many people to come and make films. And so, and I think the great focus for us is it's not about the technology. It is about the filmmaking. It is about the storytelling. And the fact you can use these high-end programs that are much less expensive amount of money, both in hardware and in software.
Well, tell me a little bit about the mix of, you know, of hardware and software that you are using, given that, you know, that's not the primary focus here.
Where's Kurt?
What's that? Where's
Kurt
when you need him? Yeah,
because yeah, exactly. you really need the guys, because a lot of it, I mean, they really do, you know, they are really building a lot of the stuff themselves. And I think it would be inappropriate for us to try and guess and tell you what they're, well, you know, what they're... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, from a technology standpoint, not, yeah, you know, the Electro Age heads could go on and
okay.
on.
My questions always are you keeping this simple?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that we don't get bogged down and we don't have conversations later on by saying, hey, we've got ourselves in a minefield here that we you've now got to write software to get us out of it.
Right, right. So, well, I guess, you know, one of the other issues I'm thinking about is, you know, sort of how is filmmaking changing, whether it's, you know, on the production side of things or the distribution side of things. I mean, what do you guys see shifting now, kind of as we're moving maybe from a celluloid world into a digital world, you know, as more pre-production and production and post is being done on, you know, laptop computers and, sure. and desktop computers. You know, I'm interested both in the, you know, in the technology, but also kind of in the way the business is going to be changing.
I think that it's you know, to use a cliche, that the more it's changing, the more it stays the same, in that, you know, we're almost leveling the playing field, where mm-hmm. sort of the kids that grew up with their 8mm cameras running around and shooting movies in the backyard are going to have a new platform where they can literally do this and show it to a broad audience. And I think that's exciting. I think, like Max alluded to earlier, then what happens is it just comes down to the best story. It's not necessarily who has the most resources.
I mean, a few years ago, you couldn't contemplate animated films being made of this quality, you know, with a small independent studio.
Uh-huh.
And that just opens up so many avenues and pathways of bringing in new talent into the industry. You're not an 800-pound gorilla, big studio with everything that comes with it. Yes, a bigger budget, but all of the constraints that come with it and the absolute... You know, it's got to be the greatest movie. It's, you know, we've got to hit a home run here.
Right.
This is a much more small and modest amount of money. And although, of course, that's our goal to do exactly that, but the way in which you go about it is different.
Well, so what budget range are we talking about, whether it's with Bunyan and Babe or with Igor?
Igor has
a full feature.
Igor has a $25 million budget.
Uh-huh.
And Bunyan is just under 15.
Uh-huh.
And I won't mention any names, but we were at a major studio talking about Paul Bunyan, and they said, yeah, you know, we could see this making $100 million at the box office, and if it did for us, it would be a colossal failure.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, for our investors, we'd be very excited.
Right, right. Because they would do it as a $60, $70 million production budget
easily,
and then
yeah.
throw marketing on
yeah.
it. Interesting. What else is changing? I mean, as you kind of see, do you guys think much about... either new ways to raise financing for films, or new distribution models and distribution paradigms, and maybe more of kind of a direct to consumer relationship, or you know, what do you guys talk about when you
yeah,
talk about how that's
changing? I mean, my main focus is certainly finding a different investment avenues and different ways of fundraising, and I think what's unique about our film fund, as far as we know, there isn't another equity private animated film fund out there. And so what it does...
Explain what that means, though.
What it means is it's an opportunity for individual investors to directly participate in the ownership, copyright, and eventually revenue generated from all animated films.
Uh-huh. So you're kind of looking at wealthy individuals and kind of what sometimes are called angel investors.
Correct.
And this is sort of all... I mean, you sort of have to create a security, basically, to do that, right?
In a sense.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
It's a private offering.
Right, right. So they're buying shares of Exodus or Electroage
no,
or
no,
of the film project?
Of the actual films themselves. All three animated projects are within a fund,
uh-huh.
which they have direct participation and ownership in.
What's the third?
The third film?
Yeah.
The three films are Igor,
uh-huh.
The Hero of Color City, and Amarillo Armadillo. Paul Bunyan's not in the fund.
Okay.
That was from a separate raise that we had done previously.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You know, you've also seen some kind of new models. I don't know if you've been following this, kind of where the internet's used, I think, not so much to solicit investments, but kind of, you know, to build communities around the idea of a movie.
Sure.
You know, one that someone pointed out to me recently was kind of, you know, this group of people that want to make a, you know, live action, really effects laden werewolf movie. And, you know, they set up the website and kind of almost started soliciting ideas from horror movie fans of, you know, what should our werewolf look like? You know, what are the rules of werewolves? You know, do they eat people or do they not eat people? You know, that just seemed kind of an interesting new direction to sort of almost build the audience base for a movie before you've really even started production.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's really important to build a following if you can, and we've certainly been approached now by a number of toy manufacturers, for example, that were very keen on talking to us about Igor dolls and toys, and I think that all of a sudden having a following and interest in the characters themselves without really even seeing the film can only benefit you.
Yeah, yeah.
I think there's an interesting balance to get there, the opportunity to get people's involvement and participation but not their ability to make it a democracy.
Right. That is hard to imagine.
Like blue. Let's make it blue. And I think that's because in your example there, the werewolf. I went, okay, that's fine, but what sort of a film should we make? Not on offer.
Yeah.
But the ability to be able to see how it's being made and become involved. I think that is, and I think that's an important part of marketing strategies going forward. The internet allows you to do that. A really quality website that allows you to almost have an eye into how it's being made.
Yeah, I mean, Superman is another example where the Superman movie that's now in production, I think in Australia, they have a website where. Where the director is literally posting kind of video clips of, here's what we did this week, and so you can kind of follow their progress as they're making the movie. And I'm sure that footage will eventually wind up in the making of DVD.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly what we're doing with Igor, and we had this discussion with Max very early on, is that we're building all these characters and these assets and these environments that we are going to use for the feature. And, of course, that's the beginning process. Why not put them into a format or a short film that we can actually exhibit? So that, again, we can build a following and start to get a buzz.
Mm-hmm. What are the other benefits of doing the short film first before the feature?
I think there are a lot of benefits. Certainly to us, there's a benefit to our investors because there is such a long production timeline in animation that it gives them the opportunity to almost see the finished movie before it's done, or at least get a sense of what it's going to be like.
But not necessarily to produce revenue, right? I mean, short films aren't necessarily...
That's definitely not being produced to generate any revenue. Possibly distribution interest, but that's about it.
Yeah.
As much as we might, we talk about the ability to be able to come and make animated films, the cost of software and hardware having, come down so much, that doesn't mean to say that it's not still an incredibly complex way of producing films. So the short also allows us to have a look at our pipeline and how it's going to work. So we're not in the middle of a feature film and trying to re-engineer something. But I think that was very, very important. So it works from a marketing point of view, but it also works from a studio production point of view, that we know what we're biting off. Because it is, $25 million, although it's a very small amount of money in terms of what a studio might spend on an animated film, it does provide an opportunity for an investor to come in and participate. But any investment has to be carefully nurtured and looked after and spent correctly, and so the short allows us to do that. So we truly, at the end of the day, we do get every penny up on the screen.
And now, just to go back, because you mentioned it again, so the film fund, have you already raised all the money for the film fund? Does it have sort of a target?
It's $50 million total.
Uh-huh.
And we have a good portion of it already committed.
Uh-huh. So you're not necessarily in kind of intense fundraising mode right now.
Oh, we are. I mean, you're always, if you're running an independent production company, you're always intense fundraising mode. But I think that we have enough money to comfortably produce the short and support our pipeline. If we had the entire $50 million sitting in the bank right now, you couldn't spend it anyway, because you have a 3-year cycle. So,
and the $50 million would cover the production, the full production
films.
Of all three.
Yeah.
Interesting. What about the distribution side of things? I mean, how do you look at... the old model was, okay, you find a distributor and they, they take care of getting into theaters and then eventually, you put it on DVD and pay-per-view and whatever. What's interesting to you about how that's changing and to me there are sort of a couple of interesting new distribution avenues. One is... potentially direct over the internet, either selling DVDs or selling downloads.
Sure.
People like Netflix are starting to buy movies, and kind of Netflix is almost becoming, dipping their toe in the water and becoming a little mini distributor.
Yeah, I think that there are a lot of very interesting distribution models. For example, with Color City, which is focused on a world of crayons. We've been talking about hooking up with a major crayon manufacturer and selling the DVD with a 64 box of crayons, and then all of a sudden you have a different channel than I think anybody's actually considered before, and reaching a different audience. So there's a lot of exciting models out there. Max and I have talked about several things.
There's one I've just become aware of, this idea for a low-budget movie, not that we're considering this for our project, but John and I haven't talked about it, is you just collapse everything and you release everything at the same time. The DVD into the theaters and on pay television, all at the same time. They're just ideas, really, that are coming up. How can you circumnavigate pirating, or how can you somehow control it? And And what about just putting it out on all formats all at the same time?
Right.
Put it in the
well, and you take advantage of your marketing spend because you just sort of have one big marketing push rather than one for theatrical, one for DVD.
Because I think there is a genuine dilemma at the moment with this window between the theatrical release and the DVD release of being ever closer. And I think we're seeing everyone's sitting here this summer going, okay, so what's wrong with this summer? Why are we down? Whatever, we're down 15-20% or whatever. And first of all, I think you have to say that the movie's just not as strong. I don't think it's a strong summer in the theatres, but when you look at the kids and what's going on, I don't think they're going to sit back to see movies again, because they know that within a very few months they can buy it, they can get it from another source. So that thing, my kids, the film's good, they'll go and see it again and again and again. I don't think they're doing all of the again and again and again that they were doing.
Yeah.
And I think it's a real dilemma. And with the piracy going on. So I think I thought that was a particularly interesting idea, just collapse the whole lot and make it available as you want it, which is a much more, if you think about consumers and what they want, they want it when they want it.
Right. So, I mean, it seems like exhibitors are really going to fight that idea, tooth and nail, just because they already don't like the shortening window between theatrical release and DVD. They're certainly not going to a simultaneous release.
Yeah, I don't know what the answer is. I mean, I do know that the movie-going experience at the moment, I don't think it's as good as it should be. I mean, there's adverts in the theaters. You can't tell any member of the public who buys a ticket who wants to sit and see TV commercials prior to the movie starting. They don't want that, although that is a revenue stream.
Mm-hmm.
They resent the amount of money it costs at the concession stand. They see that. I think most consumers actually see the value of the theater ticket on the whole pretty good. It hasn't gone up an enormous amount.
Right, it's the $5 box of Raisinets.
You go with a couple of families go together, and one family might say, "Hey, I'll get the tickets," and the other family says, "Hey, I'll get the concessions." That's not an even split.
Right.
And you come away from the concessions. You spend more on the concessions you have on the movie ticket. And I think there's something inherently wrong with the movie going experience at the moment,
mm-hmm.
and that has to be dealt with. I mean, I think on a technology front there, I think there are all sorts of things that will help in terms of piracy one day. I think when we project digitally, when we distribute digitally off a satellite, everything's encoded, and I do see all that. I mean, definitely all the studios are looking at that. And there will be cost savings in terms of prints, and quality of digital projection will be fantastic. But there's something in there about the experience at the movie theatre that's not good enough, and giving that amount of time up, I think everybody's days are just like, I know my kids, they're sitting there, homework's going on, they're doing three other things at the same time. It's not they're not doing their homework, but there's a chat room going on somewhere, there's a whole lot of their friends are all chit-chatting together, probably exchanging homework information, of course.
Right.
But they're on the internet, they're listening to this, something else is going, and the TV is on, but it's I'm not going to dedicate all of my time to one experience.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that, if you think about the last 10 years, there's been this explosion of home entertainment options. The internet really has just arrived most people's homes in the last 10 years. You've got TiVo and Netflix, and DVDs didn't really exist for most people back in 1995.
You can buy 5.1 in a box, as you're waiting in line to check out at a store, then that people are really putting an emphasis on home entertainment.
Yeah. And then when you look at movie theaters, what's been the innovation of the last 10 years? Maybe you would say stadium seating and cup holders and...
You definitely have that at home. You don't have to worry about somebody kicking your chair.
Right. Right, or someone sitting in front of you.
Yeah, I mean, isn't the thing, you sit there, how often you sit there and you get exasperated because somebody's talking all the way through the film, no matter what you said at the beginning of the movie, there's somebody there talking because... they're not used. They spend too much time at home now, because where you can talk, but sit at home and you can talk to yourself and watch it on a high quality screen and with a pretty good surround sound and get close to a movie going experience. And make your own popcorn. Right.
How would you imagine? Just to kind of ask another, last question or two about sort of the future. I mean, could you imagine a world where a theatrical release wasn't as important for a movie's success, or where the business model wasn't built on already DVD revenues are more significant than the theatrical release, but if that trend continues.
I would really hate to see that the experience goes away, because I do think that it is unique and it's still an event and should be treated as such. And I think the opportunity to take your kids to the movies is still exciting for them. And mm-hmm. for that to go away, I think, would be a shame.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I think that is the heart of it. You could look at all the secondary problems. But if the film is great, people will go out for that. I totally agree they'll go out for that experience. But also, I think that's what's exciting about all of these, you know, an independent filmmaker coming into the business and being able to make high quality films, is that's what will allow something to be different in the movie theaters. There will be a different sensibility to the films, and that's hopefully what we've got here with Igor and the rest of the slate. There's something different here.
Well, I mean, that is the hope, in, you know, as cinemas go digital, you know, the hope is that it'll be kind of more of a level playing field to get big distribution for a movie that's not a, you know, not necessarily a studio release.
Absolutely. I mean, that's certainly something that we're counting on, is to make a film that's of quality that could certainly, you know, we're not necessarily looking to compete because our budgets don't necessitate us having to. But certainly the quality of the film and the experience should be comparable.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else that kind of, when you think about sort of, you know, where the industry's headed, what's changing, you know, either in terms of new technologies or business models, I mean, anything else that's interesting to you or that you, you know, you guys think about or talk about here?
I think that, you know, we're just extremely excited that we are able to generate and produce the quality of animation that we can at the budgets we're working at. And so every day that's exciting to me. Every day that we go next door and realize what our dollars have made is to me, fascinating.
Well, I'm nodding in agreement because I'm going to repeat basically the same, you know, that is the issue.
It's exciting, right?
You know, but a few years ago, you couldn't do it.
Yeah.
You know, I had the opportunity of, you know, working with all the big studios. You needed the big budget. Everything was proprietary. It was only possible to do it that way. And what's really healthy for the movie industry is the ability to make lots of different films. I mean, you know, we've seen a great resurgence in documentary filmmaking, mm-hmm. in the last few years. I mean, documentary films that the general public aren't talking about. It's not just an industry issue. The Academy Award for the Best Documentary last year was a talking point. There were some very, very important films. But the reason they were able to be made was because of digital cameras, high-quality cameras, low-cost, easy, put them on your back, move them around very quickly. I mean, we're sitting in a room today we're sitting with three cameras on us, and all you could produce a movie, these could all be of the broadcast quality.
Right.
It was impossible a few years ago. So you didn't have the access to do it. I mean, it used to be the bugbear of documentary filmmaker, any filmmaker, was film stock. It's just like, my God, the camera's running. I mean, you know, they were the dollars just pouring away to actually, you know, record it, but then actually to print it, deciding what you're going to print. You don't mm-hmm. have any of those decisions anymore. So I think it's opened the door, and for us specializing in particularly in the animation fund, there's an opportunity now that wasn't there before. It just couldn't be done. Lots of people wanted to, but they couldn't raise the sort of money. And although when we talk about independent filmmakers, they would say to you, 25 million is not an independent film budget.
Yeah.
Because for an independent filmmaker, you know, many of them talk about under $1 million. But in terms of animation, $25 million is an independent film.
Well, I guess one interesting kind of metric to track will be, you know, the movies that get nominations in the Academy Award, you know, Best Animated Feature category, which is still relatively new. And I haven't looked at it, but I'm guessing the nominees from the last few years have all been, you know, the sort of usual suspects.
Sure.
I mean, you know, DreamWorks, Pixar, Warner Brothers.
Triplets of Belleville, which actually was a homage, really, homage is the wrong word, because it was a 2D movie, mm-hmm. but it was out of France, but it was nominated for the Oscar for feature.
Yeah.
What's really interesting, in the 2D world...
But I was just making the point that, you know, potentially you could see, you know, more independents like you guys and, you know, competing with, you know, the Pixars and DreamWorks of the world.
Absolutely. I think that will absolutely happen. But in the 2D world, you know, nobody really got invented. I mean, in those days, there wasn't an animated film, right? There wasn't an animated Oscar when the 2D animation was really the only way films were being made. So it's specifically back. But in terms of business, only Disney made any money out of it. Other studios tried from time to time, but nobody was successful because the public perceived the word Disney as meaning animation. If it didn't have Disney's name on it, it couldn't be very good.
Right.
With CGI, that's not the case. In fact, probably it's fair to say, you know, the only player that's sort of trying to emerge now into CGI as the major studios is Disney. You know, they were not in it, and Pixar with their arm, and you know, that's the story well documented. But what it really allowed, the public doesn't think about CGI in the same way of trying to relate it to a studio. Pixar, they know, but equally they're fans of the films that have come out of DreamWorks or out of Fox and And the public really does say, oh, gosh, you know, I only go and see it because it's got Pixar's name on it. That's not the case, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Done very well, thank you. You know?
I mean, I do feel like we're probably entering this age where, you know, that studio branding, not just in animation, but in live action, too, sort of becomes less important. I mean, you're making the point about documentary. You know, people will go see a documentary like Super Size Me, regardless of, you know, they haven't heard of the director, they haven't heard of, you know, who's releasing it. Do you know what I mean? It just seems like maybe those are indications that the playing field is starting to be leveled.
I think that's also, you know, really the measure of how they're starting to advertise films, which is from the producers of, and they'll name a film that was very successful and people like. It's no longer the studio, mm-hmm. and I found that interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't know that we're going to see the star system disappear where, you know, a big star like an Angelina Jolie or, you know, Tom Cruise or whoever can't attract an audience and can't open a film.
No, I don't think that'll ever go away. I mean, that's a unique characteristic about this industry.
Yeah, I mean, we should really talk about our casting.
I was going to say, because even animation is still a little, you know, is still star dependent in terms of having those names that you can.
Yeah, I mean, we feel,
you drop.
You know, maybe you can tell a little bit
about
the cast.
Yeah, our cast for the animated short for Igor is Steve Buscemi, Jay Leno, and Christian Slater, and John Cleese. I missed out the English one.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a wonderful cast, and there we are, you know, in the studio, embarking on this. I mean, it says a lot of, you know, we're taking this as a lot about the property itself.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, pitch something. And they responded to it because they, you know, I mean, I suppose everybody likes, you know, the thought of the little engine that could, and, you know, the new studio and, you know.
So how did that happen? How easy or hard was it to get those guys on board?
Well, it's always hard to get an actor of stature's attention, but I think that once they saw what the project was and saw the characters and got a real idea of what the concept is, it was relatively easy.
How about with Bunyan and Babe? Are there actors attached to that yet?
Eddie Griffin's the voice of Babe the Blue Ox, and we are looking at casting Paul relatively soon.